Welcome to the Anxiety Summit Season 2. I'm your host, Trudy Scott. I'm a food mood expert, certified nutritionist, and author of the Anti-Anxiety Food Solution. Today's topic is, are environmental toxin exposures promote anxiety? And we have Tom Maltaire with us here today. I know Tom as a fellow geeky nutrition professional and as someone who has co-written two amazing recipe books with his wife, Alyssa, who I had the great pleasure of meeting at a recent event. It was lovely to meet her. Tom, welcome.
Ah, thanks so much for having me, Trudy. I'm such a fan of yours. It's such an honor to be on this with you.
It's really great. And I know that educating both consumers and other health practitioners about toxins and allergies is a passion of yours. So I'm really pleased to have you on the Anxiety Summit to share this information.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you know, it's time, isn't it? It's really time that we shift our attention to actual therapies and ideas that are going to help more people, because it seems like the standard medical community is running around trying lots of things that aren't working. So I'm really excited to kind of raise awareness in our discussion today.
Yes, and I know you're very passionate about this. So we're going to, I know you've always a wealth of information, so we're going to have some great info here. So let me read your bio and then we'll get started. Since the age of 10, Tom Maltaire has been fascinated by the science of nutrition. In his quest to understand the genius of food and nature, he has achieved both a bachelor's and master's degree in nutritional sciences from Bastia University, learned from medical experts at the Institute for Functional Medicine, become a faculty member of the Autism Research Institute, co-authored two books, Nourishing Meals and Whole Life Nutrition Cookbook, and coached numerous healthcare practitioners on using nutritional science as a tool in their clinical practices. Through his Whole Life Nutrition Elimination Diet Program, he has helped thousands of people let go of migraines, arthritis, anxiety, skin disorders, and many other chronic conditions. Tom loves to spend time with his wife and five children hiking in the mountains, harvesting wild food, and enjoying the beauty of the Great Northwest. You can learn more at wholelifenutrition.net and his recipe blog, nourishingmeals.com. And I do want to just commend you on your beautiful recipe books, Tom. They are more than just recipe books. They have sections on digestion and allergies and a whole host of other great information, of course, a lot on toxins as well, and all with a large number of references. So really, really great books.
Thank you, Trudy. Yeah, the labor of love. You know, I mean, what happens in clinical practice is you see what's helping people get better, and you want to share that information. So that's where those books really stem from. My wife has been an incredible asset. She is amazing at coming up with recipes that meet the needs of my clients. So if I have someone who's got gluten, dairy, eggs, yeast, corn, soy sensitivity, she will adapt the recipes. And then if I'm looking for things that are GMO-free, we'll make sure that we have every single recipe with little notations on GMO ingredients and whatnot. So it's really quite fun. Yeah, it's a good time.
Great. So let's get started. The topic again, are environmental toxin exposures promote anxiety? And before we get started, I just want to share a quote from a paper published in the Journal of Environmental Health. And the lead author is Dr. Stephen Jenness, who I actually met and heard at the recent Integrative Medicine for Mental Health conference. And I'm just going to share two quotes. Toxicity and nutritional deficiency states often receive insufficient attention as common source causes of chronic disease in the developed world. And what he's saying, it's evident that a reevaluation of conventional wisdom on the current construct of disease origins should be considered. And this is why we have Tom here today to talk about toxins. So we've seen this drastic spike in ADD, ADHD, autism in the last 20 years. We know that anxiety rates and depression rates in adults have tripled since 1990. We've seen generalized anxiety and panic disorder doubled in adults since 2008. And the World Health Organization survey on depression says that by 2020, depression will be the second leading cause of disability worldwide. So let's talk about what this and what you believe the contributing factor is.
Well, sure. You know, I started this whole thing out looking at food. I mean, food is medicine in my mind, and I've been learning that since I've been a 10-year-old child. So my family doctor was Dr. John McDougall, and he said, you know, hey, look at food first for everything. So I started looking at the science, and sure enough, you know, of course, the first vegetables are there, and the antioxidants that are spread throughout the entire vegetable kingdom. And you look at some of the nutrients that are found in animal fats, like the vitamin D, vitamin K, whatnot, changing immune function. And it's been brilliant to look at food. It's been amazing. I don't see any other medication that can touch the power of food because of the quantities you're consuming on a regular basis. But as time came in and I was looking at all these different arguments between veganism and vegetarianism and the Atkins diet, because that's when I got started, was before paleo even existed. And I was like, wow, you know, what's going on here? Because I'm seeing on both sides. Some people are finding benefit here, and we're now starting to dive into a whole host of other disorders and diseases that weren't common a few years back. So it seems like, you know, throughout my decade of clinical practice, I started out seeing a lot of people who were benefiting by going gluten-free and whatnot, and all of a sudden it wasn't enough. And then all of a sudden they had to have a little bit more nutrients. And we look at other food sensitivities, like go to dairy. Oh, my goodness, some people are responding with cross-reactivity to a lot of gluten-contaminated grains. And so it kind of migrated over time to having a different focus. And pretty soon I was like, wait a second, this can't be all about food. Something else is happening. Like, why all the kids with autism? Why all this ADD, ADHD? What's going on here? And this is skyrocketing. I've never seen something change so quickly in a short period of time. I mean, my goodness, in the last couple of years, we've had a 30% rise in autism, according to CDC data. And you look over in Korea and you look over in Australia, and it's mimicked everywhere. It's not just diagnostics here, folks. It's something else. And so you start plugging in, like, oh, these theories on blood sugar, and you start plugging in all the refined carbs, and, oh, yeah, we should be looking more paleo. And to be honest with you, I can't make any of that fit statistically. It just doesn't work. We haven't had that drastic of a change in the last 2 years to fit in with all these theories we have of these early-stage eating trends. It doesn't work. Something else has to be underlying. So I look at the data, and I'm running across studies, and I start seeing all of this flood of research coming in around autism, for example. It's been part of the Autism Research Institute and their scientific roundtable. And my colleagues are saying, hey, look at this data on pollution. Look at this data on pesticides. Look at this data on EMFs. Look at this data on exposure, exposure, exposure. Creating an environment intracellularly which then changes the entire physiology of the human. And it's initiated by minute exposures. So whether you're looking at phthalates or BPAs or PCBs, minute amounts, mercury, minute amounts will shift physiology. So I start saying, aha, okay, well, what are we looking at then? What's the picture? And you see articles like that of American Academy of Pediatrics in 2011, which basically said, we are up against 74 billion pounds of chemicals. Now, 74 billion pounds of chemicals being imported or produced in the United States every single day. That doesn't include pharmaceuticals, doesn't include fuels, food additives. It doesn't include some of the primary things like pesticides that we're exposed to on a daily basis. So that number is conservative, and still to me it's completely and totally overwhelming. And that was data from 2010, the year they stopped paying attention to those chemical numbers. We've known since then, due to investor charts and whatnot, that the chemical companies have gone way up in profits, and therefore sales of many of the pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, food additives, industrial chemicals have gone way up. So those are conservative numbers. And so I say, my goodness, all right, so we have all these chemicals that we're exposed to that we weren't exposed to 10, 15, 20 years ago, because they didn't exist in the quantities that we have now. And no one, as a whole, is throwing out theories to say, huh, maybe it's the chemical shifting physiologic function. Maybe it's not the blood sugar. Maybe it's not the sugar you're consuming in your diet. Maybe it's the endocrine disrupting chemicals shifting how you metabolize sugars, shifting how your adipocytes, your fat cells, react to sugar, whether or not they store it, whether or not they tell other fat cells to turn off, whether they diminish mitochondrial function. There are so many different feedback loops that are manipulated by trace amounts of chemicals. hey, Trudy, that's not where I wanted to spend my time. This is really not as fun as looking at broccoli. I love looking at foods. I love preparing foods. I love eating foods. I love harvesting wild foods. That's where I want to spend my time. But to be honest with you, once I get into this research like I do every day, you know, it's hard to come back out. Oh, my gosh. These things have an influence. So, you know, where do we talk about? Where do we look at next? I mean, you can do anything. You pick a topic. So what do you want me to talk about when it comes to chemicals?
Okay, let's talk about air pollution and some of the sources of air pollution and why we need to be worried about it.
Okay, great. Well, let's look at that then, okay? You know, just last year, we had Lancet come out with an article showing that air pollutants are now classified as a class 1 carcinogen. Okay, so they cause cancer. We know that air pollutants cause cancer. Now, we're seeing in the news all the time, you know, about India and China. You see less about India, but it's just as bad as China. But you see these pictures of Beijing, and it's covered in this cloud, and there are traffic jams because people can't see to drive because the pollution is so bad. And then we look at data coming from health organization elsewhere pointing towards the fact that by the year 2050, air pollution may be the primary cause of death on the planet, outtaking all these infectious diseases and whatnot. And we say, whoa, this is a big issue. We are taking one of the key elements of life, air, food, water, sunshine. We're taking air and we're manipulating the particle content of the air. We're digging deep into the earth, taking things that have been stored there for thousands of years, or we're melting off in the permafrost, things that have been melted into ice for thousands of years. We're releasing this into the atmosphere. We're releasing this by the burning of coal and fossil fuels, which is the primary source of mercury in our environment. Did you know in 2010 we had 13 million pounds of mercury freed up into our environment so we can have that deposited in our ocean and our lands and water supplies everywhere? So, you know, it's like, we're burning this stuff and we're thinking it's okay. Yeah, we're providing a short-term benefit of whatever it is. We're running machinery, we're providing heat, whatever it is. And we're saying, this is okay in the short term. It should be okay. And it really doesn't appear to be. It looks like these are irritants. You've got, of course, things like mercury, which have been landing in the fish stocks. So I have this beautiful graphic of this Alaskan fishery was really concerned that they had a 20% rise in mercury in the last decade, and they've been attributing to a lot of the fossil fuel that's burning in China, forming these large structures of pollution called brown clouds. And the brown cloud is then getting whisked up into the upper jet stream, and this is NASA tracking this. You can actually go and see satellite images from NASA of the brown cloud traveling across the Pacific Ocean and depositing on Alaska, on Washington, Oregon, California. And if it's not raining or there's moisture to retain it on the westerly side of the mountain range there, the Cascades, then it will continue onwards. It will go over the Midwest and maybe even end up on the East Coast. So it's no mistake that a lot of people are finding in their waterways more mercury supplies. It's no mistake that if you start looking around the globe when people are getting tested in their hair analysis or they're looking at fish stocks, that over 90% of the average people who are tested have toxic levels of mercury in their system, and upwards of 90% of the fish stocks, there was only one, really, it was Alaskan halibut that was relatively safe to be consuming, you know, a single serving over 50% of the time, that you would have safety of actually consuming a single serving a month and not getting too much mercury. And then we dive into the whole controversy now that's being spread by many people online and in the blogosphere, and one particular researcher who was interviewed saying, oh, don't worry about the mercury in the fish, because when you have mercury in fish, as long as the fish is selenium, then the selenium will sequester the mercury or provide protection in your body by sequestering the mercury and not create the toxic environment that you would wish. And I say, oh, that's wonderful thinking. In theory, it sounds brilliant. In reality, it doesn't appear to be the case. I just did an interview with Dr. Richard Deeth, who's been looking at methylation and mercury glutathione formation and selenium, has published multiple papers on the subject. I'm quite convinced that would be the case in a real-life scenario. And the other piece that I would like to challenge is that, you know, gosh, is mercury the only thing that travels with pollution? And I would have to, you know, say no. I mean, gosh, we have alkali plants who are getting, you know, high fructose corn syrup processed, or where they're doing all sorts of different things of separating, you know, chlorine with the caustic soda, and used in lots of different industrial agricultural means of pesticides and herbicides and plastics and all sorts of different things. You know, those plants are off-gassing then the dioxins. And then we have, you know, PCBs that are aerosolized, and even flame retardants now that we're seeing in atmosphere present, as well as the usual, the polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons from combustion. So there's lots of different chemicals that are being spewed into the air that end up in the water supply, and then what's called bioaccumulate and biomagnify in animal tissue. And since most of these are petroleum-based byproducts, they are what's called lipophilic. They attach to fat. And when they attach to fat, then they travel into the fatty meats of fish and the skins and the livers of animals, large animals. And it doesn't matter if it's a grass-fed beef or whatnot. You know, if it's traveling in the air and landing on the grass, and the grass is consumed by a cow, it will concentrate in the fatty tissues. And, you know, gosh, we're also hearing, oh, don't worry about the livers of animals. They're filters, and they're not storage facilities for chemicals. And I'll say, have you seen any livers these days? The problem with modern livers is since they're under exposure to lots of chemicals, they become fatty. So even the animals have fatty livers these days, and then therefore the fats will accumulate some of the toxins that are lipophilic. So you can see this circle of, like, my goodness, we're producing this stuff in the air, and it's ending up everywhere. How's that for pollution?
Yeah, it's really bad. So I'd like to go back to a few things that you said and just get some clarification. I'd like to just get clarification on the person you interviewed, Dr. Richard, and what was his last name?
Deeth, as in D-E-T-H.
D-E-T-H, okay, great. And thank you. And then the other question was, I interviewed Kristen Homme, and she talked about mercury toxicity when it comes to consuming fish, and we had a little bit about the selenium mercury discussion. And then I also interviewed Randy Hartnell from Vital Choice, talking about fish consumption, and he is in favor of the fact that selenium is protective against mercury. But I see what you're saying is there's other components that we need to consider. And then the other thing that I wanted to ask you related to this is, would you say that going for smaller fish like sardines and salmon would be okay, or is that still a concern? Are they still going to be, you know, have high levels of these mercury and other pollutants?
Yeah, well, Trudy, you know, I'm a dad. I'm a father of five kids. And so it's really tough for me to witness all the data that I'm coming across on a daily basis. I would rather tuck my head in the sand and say this doesn't exist and eat whatever I want. But to be honest with you, being alive in the year 2014 and many people walking around just consuming and not being conscious of what we're contributing to in the way of chemical use and pollution, you know, we really need to stop and say this is a huge concern. Our food supply and the foods that are incredibly nourishing to us, you know, the organ meats of animals, the fish fats themselves, the things that we really want and or need as a species to evolve and have optimal brain function and anti-inflammatory activity, those things are in jeopardy of being polluted at this point in time. So then you're asking yourself, all right, where do you stand, and do I consume this or not consume this? And I think you're providing a really nice solution, which is consume the smaller fish that don't bioaccumulate and magnify to the same quantity that the older, larger fish might. So, yes, I definitely agree with consuming. And I love Randy, and his fish is fantastic. I would just say, you know, he will want to paint a picture of safety that I would say, you know, many people are not wanting to disclose where we're currently at because it would stop people from consuming something. Now, I would say I still consume fish in smaller quantities than I used to, but, you know, I'm very, very careful where I'm getting it from, wild Alaskan caught, and I would like smaller sources as well. So I would have to support that.
Okay, great. So you still consume fish, you say, in smaller quantities. How often would you say you eat fish?
Well, goodness. We just had salmon in our sushi rolls 2 days ago when we were going hiking. I don't know. It depends on the season and who's giving me fish or whether I caught it myself. But it could be, once a week. It could be twice a month. It could be once a month, depending on the time of the year and the availability.
Okay, great. And then you would go for the smaller fish like sardine and salmon?
Yes, I would.
What about going for the tuna, which we know is, accumulates higher levels of mercury, but using smaller fish, so before they've actually had a chance to accumulate all the mercury? Randy actually talked about that as well, and I'd love your opinion on that.
My concern, I guess, with tuna would be the migratory patterns of the tuna, so it depends on where it's coming from. But, it's going to be traveling to the ocean and long distances. Is it a possibility that it could be getting next to some plasticizing deposition areas in the current? Is it possible it could be getting a little closer to areas of the ocean that could be containing these micro beads of plastic? So here's the issue we have with plastics, right, is that plastics never truly biodegrade. I mean, they take thousands upon thousands of years. They'll break into smaller and smaller and smaller pieces. And when they do, these smaller pieces will contain the BPAs, the phthalates, the plasticizing agents that are well-known endocrine disruptors. And those can create, havoc on your hormonal systems, if you will. And then those end up in the fats of fish. And, yes, you can have that process initiated when you're consuming fish. Or, interestingly enough, some of the animals that are fed the fish and eel. So a lot of bycatch is ground up and fed to cattle, or a lot of waste catch is fed to the cattle. So whether it's the skins or the excess matter that might be put in the meal, that might end up in your food supply in a different way. So, being conscious of what you're contributing to, I think, is really important. But when it comes to tuna, I haven't been secure enough from the data that I've been reading to say that tuna is something safe to consume, if you're consuming it more than once a month. I that's just my conservative take on things.
Okay, good to hear. And, I just recently discovered this fact that fish meal is fed to cows and chickens and pigs. And I had seen some research showing that there was a higher risk of diabetes from farmed fish that had been fed fish pellets that they found were high in mercury. And I'm assuming that if you are feeding this fish meal to other animals and the fish has got mercury or the microbeads of plastic and these other pollutants that you're talking about, that could potentially get into the animal feed, which would give us a good reason to say we want to go for grass-fed, pastured chickens and food that is not being fed food that they're not supposed to eat.
Yeah, I guess my concern too is anytime you're talking about fish pellets being fed to fish and whatnot is not just the mercury, but of course the PCBs that we're witnessing. You bioaccumulate these chemicals, these endocrine disrupting chemicals that have been in the environment. They're persistent in the environment for quite a long time. That's why they're named persistent organic pollutants. And those bioaccumulate in fish quite readily, especially farm fish that have been fed lots of other fish fats. And my goodness, you'll see in some of the earlier data up to 40 times the level of PCBs in farm fish than other food supplies. And then in more recent data, you'll see it upwards closer to 10 times the amount. So I would say farm fish is probably your biggest concern when it comes to the diabetes issue and PCBs. And persistent organic pollutants, one particular study in 2006, which was fascinating, showed that it's basically upwards of 30 times the risk of diabetes in the largest group of intake of persistent organic pollutants. So it was astronomically high. Now, that hasn't been replicated, so usually you're seeing around 1.4, 2 times the risk. But my goodness, that was an indication that we should really be conscious of some of these chemicals found in farm fish with regulating blood sugar. There was a nice rat study on that, actually, and they fed the rats farmed salmon, and they could initiate early-stage diabetes with the consumption of that farmed salmon. So something to be aware of, for sure.
Excellent. I would love to get the links to some of these studies so we can share them on the blog that goes with this interview.
You know I have them. Happy to share.
Okay, great. And then, although it's not related to air pollution, I think we talked about this brown cloud from China. What about importation of foods from China? I've seen some concerns about tilapia and cod and even apple juice and mushrooms. Any comment on that?
Well, yeah, that's a piece of our life, right? I mean, everything that's growing, everything that's alive is going to need to have some sort of interaction with the atmosphere. So you're going to have some sort of air, water, soil, fire, and sunshine, some sort of interaction there. And if the air that that food is grown in is contaminated, then that will end up in the water, that will end up everywhere. So it is possible that there will be higher levels of chemicals in the foods because the air is polluted, absolutely.
Okay. So let's go on to endocrine-disrupting compounds, and I know BPA is a big one. So let's start with that one.
Oh, boy, that's a fascinating one, really. So, you know, we're now seeing that the one-to-one estrogen activity that we thought that we were supposed to be comparing BPA with standard estradiol isn't really how BPA works. It works in a secondary mechanism that's just as potent maybe as estradiol. And, you know, let's go back a little bit, and let's look back in the 1930s when this stuff really started bumping up in our use in the U.S. of A. And it was used back then as a synthetic estrogen that was added to animal feed to make the animals fat. So this original compound was a synthetic estrogen to fatten animals. Let's let that sink in for a second. And then it got repurposed later in the 1950s as a plasticizing agent. But that's not how it originally started. It was originally used for the estrogen function. So you say, oh, okay, now all of a sudden we're making 6 billion plus pounds of this stuff every year, and we're saturating it in our water bottles, and we're putting it all over the place. And now it's in our air, it's in our food, it's in our water. And you go, well, why wouldn't we be getting fat, right? I mean, it just makes sense. And even in these minute concentrations, it still seems to have a, you know, non-monotonic dose. You shouldn't be looking at dose response. It has a non-monotonic effect, meaning it can still affect your hormones, just like hormones do, in teeny levels, picogram levels, nanogram levels, just like your own hormones do. So, yeah, we're swimming in this stuff. And you say, well, gosh, well, how do I lower exposure then to BPA? And there was a really neat study a while back looking at, I believe it was Environmental Health Perspectives, looking at a typical clean diet for a few days, where they took out all packaged foods. So they took out, you know, the canned foods, and they took out stuff that was wrapped in plastic, and you ate fresh foods for, I believe it was 3 days. And after eating these fresh food diets, we saw between a 50 and 60% drop of some of these plasticizing agents like the BPA and the phthalates that would normally be found in the food that were coated or next to some sort of plastic agent. So I thought, wow, that's a lot of hope. And then your buddy, Stephen Jenis, up in Alberta, who's also a friend of mine, he said, you know, gosh, I published a study, and I was looking at how do we get these things out of people. I mean, everybody's going to have them, and they're probably changing their ability to maintain lean body weight. Then, well, what do we do? So he did a study looking at urine, looking at fecal matter, and looking at sweat. And it turns out that when you sweat, you can actually get rid of some of these plasticizing and some of the phthalates and BPAs in your sweat. So I think a good plan of attack would be, number one, lower your consumption of plastics. Because the more plastics you're consuming, the more you're contributing to an entire globe that's saturated with these plasticizing agents. Whether you're talking about the oceans, whether you're talking about the air, you want to lower wherever this stuff is going to be. So, you know, gosh, I'm looking at my life without plastics, stainless steel lunch container, my stainless steel bottle that I have here that's entirely stainless steel, even the lid. And, you know, you look at all this stuff and you say, on a daily basis, if everybody's consuming water out of plastic bottles, or we're getting our groceries in plastic bags, which now California has banned the plastic bags, and now Bellingham has already banned it over a year ago, you know, we're using a trillion plastic bags a year. And those things get thrown in the landfills and blown to oceans, and we can reduce this. So fresh foods, sweat a lot, purchase less plastics, and we'll have less of the BPA concern over time. Definitely something I want to leave for my kids. But there's a secondary plasticizing agent, speaking of kids, that we should really be looking at. And that particular one is called phthalates. And the phthalates are commonly used to combine oil and water together. So normally, you know, you put olive oil in water and you'll see the olive oil will float, right? It doesn't mix. It won't mix in.
Mm-hmm.
But I want you to be conscious of something, right? I mean, if you look at the plasticizing agents that soften plastic, the BPA, the phthalates, they'll actually allow for water to stick to the sides of the plastic. So take your Tupperware out of your dishwasher someday and notice that it's a lot wetter than the glass around it. Why? Is it just because the glass heated up and allowed some of the evaporation? Yes. But it's also because the compounds in the plastic bind to the water and hold it to the plastic. So it's interesting, you know, these oil-water combining agents. Well, they're used in personal care products, skin lotions, creams, sunscreens, hair gels, perfumes. They want to take the water and the oil and they want to combine it together so you can move a scent into a spray and spray it on you in the form of cologne or perfume. Or you want to put it on your skin and you want to have a nice color on your skin for whatever cream that you're dealing with. Any coloring or fragrance agent is normally combined with a phthalate. It's not necessarily listed on the label. If you see fragrance, if you see perfume, if you see color, then oftentimes that personal care product will contain phthalates. In fact, the average woman is using about 12 personal care products a day. The average male is using 6. And when you look, on average, you can increase the actual phthalate presence in a person by up to 30+% with the single use of a personal care product. So male who's using hair products, hair gel, for example, or a deodorant that might have phthalates in it, or a sunscreen and whatnot, might have a lot higher level. And interestingly enough, if you look at the data on this and say, well, why is that a concern? Well, we know that phthalates are endocrine disruptors. We know that children who are exposed to phthalates early on have more autism risk. We know that it changes thyroid function. And we also know this, that when women used more personal care products with phthalates in them, so they used the personal care products and their phthalate level went up in their urine, they were 4.1 times more likely to have breast cancer. So, you know, a lot of cancers are estrogen-positive cancers, the breast cancers. And so, my goodness, you know, you are increasing your physical estrogen levels. And these are what's called endocrine-disrupting chemicals, hormone-disrupting chemicals. And they're also called xenoestrogen because they mimic the activity of estrogen frequently. So you're adding in via your skincare something that seeps through your skin, gets into your body, and acts like a hormone in your body. Now, there's another class that's used in cosmetics called parabens. They have a similar effect. They're used as a preservative. They kill microbes, right? So you have a cream and you don't want it to grow bacterium in the cream. You put a paraben in there, and that paraben will actually kill the microbes. But it will also seep into your skin and create hormonal activity in your body. And there's one particular article I have. You have to show this one with your group here. It showed that the level of hormone activity from parabens is now higher in our children than their own estrogen. So we've hit a point where these xenoestrogens, these chemical-based hormone-disrupting substances, are now giving more hormonal signaling than our own hormones in our children. So if that's not a wake-up call for us to say, wait a second, what are we doing here, then I don't know what is. But let's talk about how this can actually manipulate the function of a child's brain, right? Because isn't that what you're concerned about? Isn't that your audience is going to be looking at anxiety, depression, where they're looking at, you know, something that's having to do with their brain function, correct?
Yes, absolutely. And before we go there, I just want to make sure everyone's on the same page because this is a lot of great information. So we're talking about endocrine disrupting compounds, and these are going to affect our hormones. We've talked about BPA, which stands for bisphenol A, in case you're not familiar with the term. I'm sure most people are, but in case you're not. And it was actually research in 2011, and this is just one study, in the Journal of Pediatrics that found that girls of 3 years of age had more anxiety and depressed behavior with each tenfold increase that was found in the moms that are BPA. So there is this direct correlation. And I want to go into what you're going to talk about here, but I want to also just make sure that folks know that the other compound that we were talking about was phthalates, and it's spelled P-H-T-H-A-L-A-T-E-S, phthalates. And then the other compound that we talked about were parabens. And I just want to give some takeaways here, and that is get
yeah.
rid of the plastics. That's going to reduce your exposure to the BPA. And I love that you talked about the stainless steel containers. I've got a nice stainless steel lunchbox as well, and the water bottle is fantastic. And
great.
Then the other thing is that your home care products. A great resource I'm sure you recommend to your clients is the Environmental Working Group has a really nice directory where you can look up products to see if they contain some of these endocrine disrupting chemicals in some of the products that you are using. So, anything else that you want to add to that before we go dive a little bit deeper on how this is actually doing this?
Oh, I love it. Yeah, let's talk about that real quickly. What are some of the action items when it comes to BPA phthalates and whatnot and skincare items, parabens? Is the EWG Skin Deep resources wonderful? I love that. Environmentalworkinggroup.org or EWG.org. That's awesome. And then the other piece is just let your follow your nose. It always knows, right, according to Toucan Sam. So you just smell. And if you've got something that's super perfumey, and I don't care if it's a dishwashing detergent, I don't care if it's clothes washing detergent, I don't care if it's dryer sheets, whatever it is, you've got Glade plugins in your house, you've got scented candles, all of those scents are laden with phthalates. So unless it says phthalate-free on it, the likelihood is you're sucking in endocrine disruptors with every breath. So be conscious of whatever you're spraying in your house or using in your house, on your dishes, whatever it is, and try and clean that up as much as possible because it will shift
excellent.
The behaviors of your children. Yeah.
Excellent tip. And you can smell that. You walk into a room, in a restroom, and you've got that strong smell. And you think, what is that? And I think we get used to it. But being aware, and as you say, using that, just be sensible. Use your sense of smell. That's a really great tip.
Yeah. Fantastic. So other things, what else would you like to know about when it comes to chemicals and brain function?
Yeah, you were going to talk about how these endocrine disrupting compounds are actually contribute to anxiety and depression and brain issues.
It's kind of complicated in that there are so many different facets that EDCs or endocrine disrupting compounds can actually shift brain function. But one fascinating one that I've been looking at lately, and you know me, I can go down 10 different avenues right now, is how BPA alters vitamin D function. Whoa, how does that sound for obtuse?
Wow.
So, BPA, and there was this really awesome review paper, I have to pass this to you as well, Karazian just published about how BPA might be contributing to autoimmune diseases. And, I'm like, wow, what's one of the key players to dampen down immune function in the human body? What's the key player to dampen down excessive inflammation in the central nervous system? So let's say my gut is upset and I start releasing inflammatory cytokines. And let's say I'm stressed and I start releasing inflammatory cytokines. What's the turnoff switch for the inflammation in the central nervous system? And we've seen that from early MS studies from the University of Wisconsin-Madison and Colleen Hayes and her group and whatnot, that you can shut off the inflammatory response in the central nervous system by having adequate vitamin D. So vitamin D, interestingly enough, is metabolized via hydroxylase enzymes, the cytochrome P450 enzyme.
Mm-hmm.
And you do in the liver the 25 hydroxylase, and you do the 1 hydroxylase pretty much in every cell of the body. And so these hydroxylase enzymes are great. You want those activities, flourishing. But there's another hydroxylase. It's called the 24-hydroxylase. And if you activate that by influencing your body with the exposure of certain chemical, then that 24-hydroxylase will actually completely denature, it changes the shape of, I should say, not denature. It will change the shape of by adding an extra 24-hydroxyl group to the vitamin D. Now all of a sudden you have a 24-25 or a 1,24-25 dihydroxycholecalciferol, and that's completely inactive. It gets metabolized quite quickly, degraded, and all of a sudden you don't have vitamin D around. So by having excessive levels of chemicals like BPA, you can actually inactivate vitamin D. And vitamin D is a key component for turning off inflammation in the central nervous system, which is in your brain region. So I'm sure other people have been talking about excessive inflammation in the brain leading to excitatory glutamate connection with NMDA and then leading to anxiety. And has that been discussed already?
It will be when I interview Dr. Kelly Brogan. I haven't done an interview yet, but we're going to talk extensively about inflammation.
Ah, fantastic. Okay. So, yeah, what you'll see is that this vitamin D is an excellent turn-off switch. So one of the many ways that these endocrine disruptors can do that is through the modification of vitamin D. But I could go on forever, but we should probably talk about one other piece that's so important if we're going to talk about this whole activation of neurotransmitters and depression and anxiety, and that's the influence of pesticides. Have you talked to Jeffrey Smith and the rest of the crew about that?
Yes, so I'm glad that we're going to talk about this because Jeffrey Smith is on the summit, and we talked extensively about the effects of Roundup, and I would love you to go a little bit deeper into how Roundup can affect tryptophan and serotonin and catecholamine production.
Oh, yeah, great. Well, let's start from the beginning. a deer, a female deer. Let's look at the actual ingredients that you need for a neurotransmitter. So if you're looking at serotonergic or dopaminergic pathways, you're looking at starting with tryptophan for serotonin, or you're looking at phenylalanine and tyrosine for dopamine and epinephrine or epinephrine. So we say, okay, if we need tryptophan and phenylalanine and tyrosine to even start this building process, where are those coming from? And did you know those are not produced by any animal alive on this planet? They're only produced, the aromatic amino acids are only produced in plants and in bacterium via the shikimate pathway, the EPSPS enzyme. So if you want to form those aromatic, those wonderful rings to make these amino acids, you have to be getting those from the plants, from the bacterium, in that particular pathway. And I'm sure Jeffrey has said, look, the relative activity that occurs in the presence of glyphosate in plants and in microbes is due to its inhibition, its blocking of the function of the actual enzyme that makes tryptophan, phenylalanine, and tyrosine. That's how the plant ends up being weak and dying, is it can't form amino acids, the aromatics specifically, and that's how the organisms die that are exposed to Roundup. So, it's patented as a biocidal. It kills microbes. It kills other organisms, because it steals away the activity of this enzyme, and that animal can no longer have the aromatic amino acids, amongst other things. It can't have caffeic and ferulic acid formed. It can't have folates formed. It can't have a lot of different things that are formed in the presence of that enzyme, because it's been inhibited by this Roundup, this chemical, this active constituent, glyphosate, right? Okay, so you can't have the precursors coming from the plants. You can't have it coming from the bacterium very frequently. Now, if you are also knocking out the organisms with the exposure of Roundup, right, that form these things, and you're inhibiting the enzyme, then you've got this ability to deplete the availability of tryptophan, phenylalanine, and tyrosine. So I don't think anybody's really looking at this, and we really should be. We should be tracking whether or not the global supplies and stores are going down of these particular amino acids, because we're using something that's a very well-known inhibitor of the enzyme that makes them. We're doing hundreds of millions of pounds of this stuff every single year, and yet we're not looking at whether or not this could be affecting our environment in such a manner, which seems interesting to me. The other piece is the folates are formed in our microbes in our colon, and some of the bifidobacterium, for example, that form these folates were known to be knocked out by exposure to Roundup. So in the animals, there was a poultry study, there was a beef study, and we're seeing that, you know, when they looked at this, they said, wow, you know, some of these organisms were knocked out when they were exposed to this Roundup. And what is that doing then to what the organisms normally produce? So if the organisms are producing tryptophan, phenylalanine, tyrosine in our own guts, and they're also producing folate, are we leaving ourselves more susceptible for a diminished supply of the building blocks of neurotransmitters? That's a question no one else is asking as well, because look at this. You need tryptophan to turn into 5-hydroxytryptophan to turn into serotonin for you to get serotonin, right? The enzyme that takes tryptophan to 5-hydroxytryptophan is a tryptophan hydroxylase enzyme, and that enzyme will allow you to have the next step for serotonin, but it had to use folates in the form of tetrahydrobiopterin, and it had to use antioxidants to get there. Okay. Folates were formed by what? Oh, yeah. Plants and bacteria. They also have a pterin ring that's formed in the EPSPS enzyme, that chicanate pathway. So now I'm saying I don't have the folate backbone to make the tetrahydrobiopterin, which is pterin ring, bio-pterin ring. So I couldn't form adequate tetrahydrobiopterin. So I have two strikes. But here's a third strike. All the chemicals I'm talking about, BPA, air pollutants, pesticides, all these chemicals, when you look at them, have mitochondrial inhibiting action, meaning they create more of a free radical state in your body versus an antioxidant state. They're like the opposite of antioxidants. And it turns out that one of the most important steps people are missing in depression and anxiety is the fact that when you take away antioxidant function of the body, you take away enzyme function. You take away one of the most potent key cofactors in this compound transition from tryptophan to serotonin and phenylalanine and tyrosine to L-dopa and dopamine is this tetrahydrobiopterin. And tetrahydrobiopterin, oh my gosh, is extremely oxidant sensitive. So, you know, I don't know if you've been paying attention to this, Trudy. I mean, a lot of people who are in anxiety and depression are saying, oh, just take tetrahydrobiopterin, a BH4 supplementation, and you can reverse depression. You can reverse anxiety. But, oh, my gosh, if you are a supplement manufacturer, and I worked at 7 years at Thorne as part of the medical affairs team, we'll tell you it's extremely hard to prepare tetrahydrobiopterin because it is so oxidant sensitive. You have to put it in vials. You have to make it, you know, not exposed to oxygen. You have to refrigerate it. You have to stabilize it somehow, so it doesn't get oxidized. Well, the same thing's happening in your brain. If you're walking around and you're exposed to a lot of free radical substances, air pollution, for example, which causes excessive inflammation in the brain, or electromagnetic frequencies that can stimulate inflammation in the brain, then, oh my goodness, you have to understand that you're probably not making adequate neurotransmitters, because you have not stabilized the cofactor to allow that to occur. Wow, that's kind of complicated. Did you get all that?
That's really good information, and it's important that folks know this.
Yeah. So, you know, the one piece that I love that people are concentrating on folates and methyl B12 and, you know, 5-methyltetrahydrofolate. But the other aspect that people aren't looking at is each one of those are donors of electrons, meaning they are antioxidants. So if you're taking Deplin for depression, if you're taking high-dose 5-methyltetrahydrofolate, if you're doing any of these supplements to help you with your depression because you want methylating reactions, FAMI, whatever it is you're looking for, you need to be conscious of the fact that if you're going into a brain that's on fire, you're likely going to take off the electrons from those particular substances, and they're not going to be able to do their jobs very well. Long story short, more antioxidants, less toxins. The more toxins we have, the more oxidative stress we have. the more oxidative stress we have, the more physiologic emotional stress we have. We don't have the neurotransmitter buffers of things like serotonin to calm us down. And guess what? Serotonin, melatonin, 5-HTP are all antioxidants. They donate electrons. So even after you've made the end product of the neurotransmitters, if you're still under a state of oxidative stress, you will use those as antioxidants. Oh, was that too complicated? Did we get that across?
That was deep. That was heavy. But that's good. It's good to know. So we're going to go into the antioxidants and some of the things that we can do about this other than avoiding exposure to all of these. But I've got a few follow-up questions on some of this. One is the tetrahydrobiopterin. I've never used it as a supplement, and you said it's hard to prepare because it's easily oxidized. Do you know of a source that's good, and have you ever used it with good results?
I don't use it these days. I don't. And the reason is because it's extremely expensive. The last I saw it was in vials coming from Germany, and it was cost prohibitive. It was so expensive for a single dose that you may as well try the methylating nutrients and antioxidants.
Okay.
So what I'm doing instead is I'm doing broccoli sprouts, you know, all the cruciferous vegetables, broccoli, cauliflower, cabbage, kale, Brussels sprouts. I'm doing N-acetylcysteine. I'm doing coenzyme Q10, B vitamins. I'm doing things to promote the body's formation of that on its own. Because even if you give tetrahydrobiopterin, I mean, God, you're going to be relying on that, right? Wouldn't it be great if your body could do it on its own?
Exactly. So, yeah, and that's what we want. We want to give the body the raw material so it can do that. Okay.
Yeah.
And then I've got another follow-up question, and I just want to make sure that folks, you know, Roundup is not just used, it's, you know, extensively used on sugar, cane crops and wheat before it's harvested to kill the wheat and the sugar cane so it can easily be harvested. But it's also used extensively in yards, and people are using it all over. It's used in, you know, schools, and it's used on playgrounds. So a big thing would be awareness and, you know, not thinking that Roundup is harmless. A lot of people just think, oh, wow, I didn't realize Roundup was so dangerous. So this is glyphosate and Roundup, a lot of research. We interviewed Dr. Stephanie Seneff on season one of the Anxiety Summit, and she went into Roundup extensively. I've got a follow-up question. There's a lot of research looking at organophosphate pesticides and how those can contribute to anxiety and depression. One particular study looked at sheep farmers who were exposed to really low levels, and they had cognitive issues, memory issues, and increased anxiety and depression. Do you know if the other pesticides work in similar ways to what you've just described that the Roundup does?
Well, here's what I can. There was a recent study. Did you see the one that just came out this week too on depression and use of pesticides? It's going to be a different mechanism possibly, and or a similar mechanism. But here's the problem: to try and isolate a single mechanism is absurd. I see this in autism. I see this everywhere where everybody's looking at the one causal factor. But that's not how life works. Life always works in a symphony of reactions.
Mm-hmm.
So I would imagine that, yes, similarly with the inhibition, the interplay of oxidative stress of tetrahydrobiopterin is one of the many ways in which many pesticides work, but I'm sure there are other ways as well. I mean, they're direct endocrine disruptors. They may activate that same 24-hydroxylase. It degrades vitamin D. In fact, there are over 106 different pesticides tested that do activate that particular 24-hydroxylase. So there, you know, everything I mentioned, there's probably 10 more, if not 20, if not 1,000 mechanisms in which the pesticides can have an effect.
Okay,
so,
good point. Yeah, and we don't, and there's so many, they're not all studied, and we don't see the combination of all of these things together being studied. So, and then we've also got biochemical individuality.
Right.
And, So there's so many factors that can go into it. The fact that it's causing problems is problematic, but you taking a deeper dive into this and sharing some of the mechanisms has been very, very interesting. I really want to get to some of the solutions other than getting, you know, exposure to some of these away. Before we go into your whole discussion about broccoli and some of these other wonderful foods, can you just share a little bit about TILT, T-I-L-T? It was something that was, this term was new to me. I see it's been around for a while. I just didn't know the terminology. And just tell us what it means and very quickly, you know, how it ties into all of this.
Yes, and I would be happy to. You know, I just finished a book called The Elimination Diet, and I got to dive into the research in the 1700s, 1800s, 1900s. And I was noticing is that there was a trend in the early 1900s where people were starting to see that more and more people were reacting negatively to food. I mean, hay fever did not exist prior to the early 1900s, really, in statistical analysis. I mean, it was really, really rare. And neither did gluten sensitivity to the rate we have it today, or dairy sensitivity, or egg intolerance, or anything. So, or peanut allergies, for that matter. So I was like, wow, what's going on? So I was like, you know, what it seems like is that the immune cells that are normally sentinels, that are supposed to be monitoring the outside environment and saying, okay, this is friend, this is foe, this is okay, this is not okay, I'm going to attack this, I'm not going to attack this, all of a sudden we're starting to attack everything. They were losing tolerance. So instead of looking at things, recognizing them as safe, they were looking at things and attacking them. So this loss of tolerance was something that was relatively new. And it seemed to occur around the time that there was a drastic increased use of industrial agricultural chemicals, in a time when there was a boom in industry and there was a rise in pollution. So I thought it was fascinating. And then later on, I came across, in the Autism Research Institute realm, I came across Dr. Claudia Miller. And Dr. Claudia Miller has been looking at, you know, occupational exposures to chemicals and whatnot, and she termed this TILT, toxicant-induced loss of tolerance, because she said, this is fascinating. You know, I have these people who get exposed to chemical spills or brand-new office supply stores that were built over foundations that were toxic or whatnot, and within days, these people develop these allergies and food sensitivities and chemical sensitivities. It's as if they're immune cells lose tolerance. So she has this wonderful website, ClaudiaMiller.com, and she has this wonderful pamphlet, PDF pamphlet, to she describes TILT and what happens in the process, and how, you know, these immune cells that are supposed to be going around and their primary job is supposed to not react are getting overwhelmed by these toxicant exposures, and they're starting to react to everything. So that's in essence the term, and that's why I loved for people to look with ADD, ADHD, and food intolerances, to tie those two in together and to say, look, most often these people are hyper-inflammatory. They are overreactive with their immune response. And if we can calm that immune response down, their anxiety goes down, their depression goes down. All of a sudden they're sane, they're happy, they're well-rested. They sleep throughout the entire night, deep sleep. And we say, aha, it's all part of the same thing. We get rid of the food sensitivities, which dampen down the amount of immune cell stimulation, and then they're not attacking their own cells, they're not attacking their brain, they're not over-inflamed. So it's this circle of just calming down, you know, getting rid of the irritants, increasing the nutrients. And TILT is basically, a modern issue. We're all mildly tilted to a point because our immune cells are overwhelmed with dealing with our toxicant exposure.
Great. And that leads us on to the final question is, let's talk about some of the solutions that we have. You've talked about some of the antioxidants. We've talked about getting rid of exposure, you know, replacing plastic, not doing the smelly things. We want to eat organic. We want to eat grass-fed, pastured chickens, and not using Roundup. And then the other thing before you go into some of the broccoli discussion and the detoxification discussion is, I think we want to make a stand. We want to be educated about the fact that pollution is all around us, and we want to make a stand and say, hey, something needs to be done about this. Wouldn't you agree with that?
I we can stop this overnight. If everybody just stopped tolerating what's happening around them and taking it for granted, taking it for law, taking it as it's okay for everybody to be consuming a ton of, you know, chemical-laden processed industrial foods. It's okay for us to be polluting our environment by not being conscious of alternate fuel sources. It's okay to be consuming clothes that came from a place that saturated hundreds of thousands, if not millions of pounds of chemicals to produce the dyes or the pesticides and herbicides sprayed on the cotton. You know, the minute we all stand up and say, as a consumer, I want to know where my products came from. I want to know what I influenced with the purchase of my dollar. What did I just do today? And by doing that with our food, our clothing, our housing, by going more green all the way around, we will leave our planet viable in order to sustain life for the next seven generations. I mean, the Native Americans always did that, right? And they always thought, okay, if I do this now, what's going to happen to my children? What's going to happen to my children's children? What's going to happen to their children? So, you know, we just need to look farther out. We have to be conscious of what it is we're doing. So the organics are a great start, making sure you're buying products that support a clean planet, a clean environment for your food to be raised in and your kids to be raised in and your air to be exposed to. So, yeah, that's great. And then being conscious of what you're putting on your skin, in your mouth. You know, there's so many products that you're consuming on a daily basis that expose you to chemicals that are changing your health. So that's the key place that I think is fabulous to start. If you can make sure that, you know, your floors aren't made of vinyl so you don't get off-gassing of phthalates and you don't have a lot of formaldehyde-laden wood furniture, that's awesome. If you do, then definitely consider an air purifier. If you already are getting natural spring water that's fed off of glaciers, awesome. If you're not, then, you know, consider a reverse osmosis purifier. That'd be great. And then, of course, that organic label for anything, whether it's your clothes or your food, it's a great start. So, you know, you can make purchases every day that make a change on the planet.
Excellent. Now, I know that the gift that you have is a great video on how to harness broccoli's superhero detoxification power. And I know you did a wonderful TEDx talk on broccoli as being one of the superheroes. What do you call it? Broccoli, the DNA whisperer. I love it.
Yeah, it was fun.
It was a really great talk. So anything that you can just share with us about why broccoli might be a good choice to incorporate?
Well, absolutely. You know, back in 1992, the Johns Hopkins researchers, Paul Talley and Dr. King, they went in and they said, we want to find the substance in nature that turns on detoxification better than anything else. And they came up with sulforaphane coming from the cruciferous vegetables. And it eloquently reads a part of your DNA called the antioxidant response element. It starts producing lots of proteins that help you not only combat all the toxins, they help you excrete the toxins, and they help you increase your level of antioxidants in every single cell. It's phenomenal, the activity that this chemical constituent can do, the sulforaphane from, you know, watercress and from cabbage and from radishes, daikon and others. It's amazing. So I have a hard time shutting my mouth about it, really. That's where the TED Talk came from. I just was like, oh, my gosh, everybody's got to know about this stuff, right? And thankfully, there's a lot of data coming out about it around the globe. And I just did a Hashimoto's Institute lecture as well where I dispelled the myth that cruciferous vegetables cause goiters and they cause Hashimoto's issue. And really, it has to be an extremely high amount, over 2 pounds of raw cruciferous vegetables a day. Most likely you have to be iodine insufficient and have a thyroid problem to begin with. So in other words, it's a moot point, right? I mean, everybody should just eat broccoli. You know, you don't have to eat 2 pounds a day, but a serving every day or at least every other day will do wonders for your health. And when I put people on elimination diets, for example, we'll put them on broccoli sprouts and we'll have them eating lots of cruciferous vegetables and they feel better. Even if they can't stick on the diet, if they just keep that one thing up, I mean, you'll feel better. It's amazing. So, yeah, if you want to kind of turn the tide on being overwhelmed in your system with toxins, you can kind of help some of them get out of your system and help protect your cells by consuming broccoli, cauliflower, cabbage, kale, Brussels sprouts, watercress, and arugula. They're great.
Wonderful. So, and this will be, we'll share the link on the replay page so you can get access to Tom's great video. And of course, I'll share the link to the TED Talk, which was fantastic. And I think this has been absolutely amazing. We've learned so much about how environmental toxin exposures can promote anxiety and other health problems, and some things that we can actually do about it. So we can start to eliminate some of our toxin exposures, and then eating these beautiful foods like the cruciferous vegetables that can make such a big difference. And I want to just give you an opportunity to any last words of wisdom, Tom?
Don't underestimate your power. Really, as people are alive today, we can do so much to change what happens tomorrow, but we just need to keep our eyes open and conscious. So, you know, go out and enjoy life and really be conscious of what's going on. And I'll tell you, together we can create a future that's going to be fabulous.
Great. Well, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom, your very factual presentation, doing a deep dive. I knew you would do a deep dive into some of this, and I appreciate it. We need to, you know some of these mechanisms. It gives us a better understanding of what's going on. So thank you very much for sharing with us today and for your wonderful books. We'll make sure to share your new allergy book on the website as well. Give us the name of your new allergy book.
It's called The Elimination Diet, and it gets released in March of 2015. But you can do, pre-purchases, and you'll see that there's going to be some items available on our page here, lickety-split, that will make it well worth your while to participate in elimination diets before the book comes out.
Congratulations. I'm excited to see it. I know it'll be good based on this presentation and everything that you do. Well, thanks, Tom. Thanks very much for spending time with us today and sharing this. And thank you, everyone, for joining us for yet another great interview on the Anxiety Summit. I look forward to seeing you on subsequent interviews. This is Trudy Scott signing off.